The psalmist in Psalm 30 is inviting the assembly to join in a public act of thanksgiving to God who has rescued him from a mortal illness. In keeping with the understanding of his times, he sees his sickness as God's punishment for his sins. However, God has heard his cry and had compassion or pity for him. That's my brief introduction. You see if that adequately, or pick up what you can from the psalm itself. Verse 1, I will praise you, Yahweh, for you have snatched me up. You have not let my foes rejoice over me. Yahweh, my God, I cried to you for help, and you healed me. Yahweh, you have brought me up from Sheol. You restored me to life when I was going down into the pit. He was on slippery slope to death, to burial, the pit. And of course, Sheol is the mythical name now for the place of the dead, which is down under the ground in the third level. The heavens is where God is, the earth's where we live, and down under there's the Sheol, where the dead range around in some wispy thing. And we only know that much because every now and then we see ghosts. So we know there the dead come back to life, and they look something like that. And they're quiet, and they're like the king of Macbeth, Dad, and so on. And they're on the... Right, I've got all that. So this chap was just about dead, but he recovered thanks to God's grace. And so he continues in Psalm 5, inviting us to praise God for this. Sing praises to Yahweh, you his faithful ones, Hasid, the Hasidim, those who accept the Hesed, the covenant of God, and respond in love, and are faithful to their part of the covenant by keeping the commandments, by doing God's will, by teaching their children, by living a life that's just and all of that. Well, you ones, sing praise to the God. Give thanks to his holy name. His anger, which he presumes was behind his sickness, you see. We needn't presume that. We wouldn't presume that. But he did. His world did. So he was sick. He nearly died. So God must have been punishing him for something. He did, or his father did, or his grandfather did. So you never get out of this mental framework, because even if you hadn't done anything wrong, how do you prove your father didn't do something wrong? Or even, on the last possible, maybe your mother. But it would be your father, because your life comes from your father in their mentality. See, the mother's just the garden, you can't blame her. But Dad's seed was what I came from in their bung biology. So these people are full of bung biology, bung physiology, bung things, like I'm full of bung lot of things too. And they're doing the best with what information they've got. And they can still be inspired. His anger lasts for a moment, his favour throughout life. Weeping may linger for the night, but joy comes with the morning. So he's recovered from a mortal illness, thanks be to God. Here's Isaiah chapter 54. Part of that lovely second Isaiah scroll, or part of the Isaiah scroll, Isaiah 54:7. For a brief moment I abandoned you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In overflowing wrath, for a moment I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love I will have compassion on you, says Yahweh, your Redeemer. Written by the prophet in Babylon when he's heard that Cyrus of Persia, way out there somewhere, news is filtering through to Babylon that Cyrus of Persia is gradually taking over the Babylonian Empire, and wherever Cyrus goes, he let people go home. He wasn't into dislodging people. He allowed them to go home, and he wanted them to have a strong home base and let them have their own temples and their own religion, so long as they were... He was into trade, a very enlightened Persian empire. May come again. So
wanting them to be, so he could hear all this. So it aroused hope among the Jews that when Cyrus comes to Babylon, he's going to let us go home too. God has chosen Cyrus, this Persian unknown king, and they even call him the Mashiach, the Messiah. They're so keen on what, because God can use anyone to, who wants to listen, to be a vehicle of his judgment. So this is all the hope, and he's saying, look, you, the people, you've been in this dreadful place, you've lost Jerusalem, the king, etc., here you are, but ever with overflowing wrath, for a moment I hid my face from you. God hid his face from you when Jerusalem was destroyed, etc., but with everlasting love, God has compassion on us, and wait, we're about to go back. What kind of a leader do we need? And all of that. And it's a beautiful poetry there of incredible hope, and well, if you keep reading, however, when you get to the end of chapter 55, yeah, this chapter, and one after this one, chapter 56 is actually written by the disciples of the prophet in exile after they returned to Jerusalem. And a lot of the hopes were not realized. A lot of the priests, a lot of the clerics, a lot of the power brokers tightened things up and didn't follow Isaiah's prophecy, but tried to, for example, they sent all their Moabite wives home, they tried to become powerful in a ghetto sense, you know, of their community. And there's obviously a fight going on, and the disciples of Isaiah, the Deuteronomy, again, beautiful stuff, trying to keep the people open to mission, to God, to real faith, but they're fighting against a system which is narrowing them down. A fight that I think you might recognize is still going on in all our religious communities between the open, may I say, Catholic vision that believes in God and another narrower vision that wants stability and power and hard lines and clarity and black and white reality. And it's not surprising that it's the people in power who seem to want the latter. So one can be a little cynical about some of this, and one has to be alert to it. And never forget that Jesus was crucified by the religious leaders of his day. Let that thought never leave your minds. Verse 6. As for me, says the author who's been saved from death, in my prosperity, when everything was going great for me, and he doesn't mean just when he was a teenager and he knew everything, and you parents just know nothing, because you're just way out and wacko and belong to an earlier world, whereas this 18-year-old here knows everything about everything. Maybe you haven't experienced that. Maybe you have. But it's likely that there's a bit of it around. Or this brash young priest who's just ordained and he's 25 and he knows better than the Vatican. Or whatever. This, in my prosperity, I said, nothing will ever disturb me. You know, I've got it all together. And then, thank God, life comes and humbles us a bit and makes us a bit more compassionate and a bit more faithful and all the rest of it. Here's Psalm 10, which we've done already, that picks up a bit of that little, the wicked boast of the desires of their heart, those greedy for gain curse and renounce Yahweh. In the pride of their countenance, the wicked say, God won't seek it out. All their thoughts are, there's no God. Their ways prosper at all times. They're doing wonderfully. They're a millionaire at 25. Your judgments are on high and out of sight. As for their foes, they scoff at them, and they think in their heart, nothing will ever disturb us. Throughout all generations, we won't meet with adversity. A long statement, Psalm 10, verse 3, of the little repetition that we find here in Psalm 30. As for me, I said in my prosperity, nothing will disturb me. But our psalm goes on, verse 7, by your favor, your grace, Yahweh, you had established me on a secure mountain. You don't have to get to what mountain that was, the mountain of Jerusalem, the mountain of the temple. Then you hid your face, and I was confused. What profit is there in my death, in my going down to the pit? Will the dust praise you? Will it tell of your faithfulness? Kubler-Ross comes in here, bargaining. What's the point of my dying, God? Because if I'm dead, there'll be one less person to praise you. I think you should keep me alive. And then, you know, to give you praise. And then you're better off and I'm better off. Win-win situation. So a little bit of a bargaining going on. And very reasonable. I'm sure we'll all do it in different ways. And what a good thing to do. But then he goes on with three punchy lines. Hear me, Yahweh. Be gracious to me. Yahweh, help me. And I've given you the three Hebrew roots there because they come Shama. Samuel is Shamael. Samuel means he who hears God. So if you've got a child or a cousin called Samuel, remind them. Well, if you've got a name like Samuel, you better do some listening, lad, and listen to the deepest part of what's going on. In fact, I do this all the time with young people, but they're not unimpressed, I tell you. It's, you know, when you say, what's your name, and you tell them what their name means, I don't reckon they forget. You know, it locks in somewhere, because it's another way of, I don't know, whatever. So, Shema, Samuel. Hanan, be great. Yohanan, John, Joanna, Jean, all these words are all to do with grace, graciousness. Yohanan means Yahweh is gracious. All the different ways that God shows grace. So you remind someone called John to get down and think about all the beautiful ways that he, or if it's Joanna or whatever the equivalent is in the female world, all the different ways in which God has graced them through their life. And they'll remember that and think, wow, yeah, this is wonderful. And their faith will deepen. And Azar, Azariah, you don't often get that in English, but you can find it. Help me. Prayer. You have turned, verse 11, you've turned my mourning into dancing. You've taken off my sackcloth and clothed me with joy. Well, you've taken off my sackcloth and clothed me with joy. Here's a bit of Isaiah 65, towards the end of the Isaiah scroll, the disciples of the anonymous exilic prophet in the return with the new temple. And the lovely thing they say, I'm about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former thing shall be remembered or not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating, for I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. Can't we all wait for that? When Jerusalem is an international city, where Christians and Muslims and Jews can come together, admire each other, and celebrate their rituals and their memories in love, and have everybody around clapping them. Everyone claps the Muslims when they do their beautiful prayer, and then it's the Jews' turn, and we all think, isn't this beautiful? And we all say, happy and good, and then the Christians come in, and then they're all just absolutely amazed at this beautiful, loving group of people. Why not? It's not impossible. Wonderful. 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 I will rejoice in Jerusalem and delight in my people. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard on it, or the cry of distress. No more shall there be an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. For one who dies at 100 years will be considered a youth. Don't take it too literally, but it's good. It's poetry, but it's good poetry if you're 99. One who lives, and one who falls short of 100 will be considered cursed, meaning not blessed by God. They shall build houses and live in them and plant vineyards and eat their fruit, they won't have an enemy coming in to take it. They'll just be able to enjoy their life with the liberty and the freedom and the creativity that human beings need and long for. And so the psalm concludes, Psalm 30, verse 12, "And so that I," this is an extraordinary little line here, I'm not sure how to translate it, but literally it is, "so that I, your glory," that's the literal Hebrew, "I, your glory, may praise you and not be silent." So return to health, he's made a vow and he's going to be praising God forever. He's really into it. Mass and communion every day, that kind of thing, you know. "Yahweh, my God, I'll never cease from thanking you." And good on him. Wonderful. Because it is God's grace. And that reminded me, of course, as it will you, of that famous saying of Irenaeus. "The glory of God is a person who is fully alive." And you parents, particularly every one of you, but and me too, but who's not a parent, but if those of you who are parents will know, the glory that is yours when your child is lovely, beautiful, outgoing, mature, creative, and you get such joy from it because you've put... I did a wedding on the weekend, beautiful wedding. I married the parents and baptised all the 7 kids. There's no quite family, I've been that much. So I went down to do the first wedding of the eldest boy in the family, and it was a beautiful wedding, you know, what you'd expect. Young people dancing and happy and plenty of faith and all the rest of it. And just a wonderful experience for me, for the parents, for everybody. And the parents' speeches, which are always the most important speeches at a wedding, where both fathers spoke well and one of the mothers. And it was all just really wonderful stuff. And we need to see more of it. Well, that's what the glory of those parents was, to see their son and their daughter fully alive and maturely in love. In fact, I'll tell you, they wrote out this thing, and one of the first reading was Shakespeare's sonnet, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediment," and I went on. So I thought, well, that's what they chose, that's, I'll give it to them, full bore. So my homily was on what are the impediments and what is a true mind, a marriage of true minds. So it was a bit deep. And halfway through I said, boy, this is deep. But the parents said, no, the kids were listening. So, what is it? Because it is a marriage of true minds, isn't it? It's a marriage of everything else too, but the true mind, what is a true mind? And I won't give you the homily now. But here it is. I, your glory, if that's what he's saying, I, this psalmist, is, I'm your glory because I'm the one you love, I'm the one that shows how beautiful you are and how wonderful you are in your healing love, and I'm going to glorify you forever anyhow. Here's a John's Gospel 16, Last Supper. "Very truly I tell you, you will weep and mourn, but the world will rejoice." The world, he put negatively. They'll rejoice to see you weeping and mourning, you southern Sudanese Christian women and kids and men. "You'll have pain, but your pain will be turned into joy. When a woman is in labor, she has pain because her hour has come. But when her child is born, she no longer remembers the anguish because of the joy of having brought a human being into the world. So you have pain now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you." We are talking about the resurrection. We're talking about something beyond death. And we should talk about it, because that's the goal of our life. Or as Paul says, "As all die in Adam, all will be made alive in Christ."